Welcome to the Urban Mission Podcast. We hope you enjoy this message. For more information about Urban Mission and other resources, visit urbanmissionjc.com.
Good morning. Am I on? I can't tell. Am I on? Hello? Hello? Yeah? Okay. You got something on your shirt. Happy Father's Day and happy potential Father's Day for you fathers who are not yet fathers but will be, those of you online as well. It's an exciting day today, and today we are going to celebrate fatherhood. I mean, we need to celebrate fatherhood, especially now. There's been such, like David said, I'm going to kind of pick up on that. There's been such an attack on fathers the past few years that it's hard to even comprehend what's like been going on. It's hard for me to even contemplate. When you look at the big picture, it could be overwhelming of what's going on. And it seems like men have been raked over the coals for simply being who God created them to be. And God created men to be masculine and women to be feminine. But if a man acts masculine today, he's told he's toxic, right? And I'm not talking about a man acting tough or macho. I mean, today, if you stand up for your rights, or if a guy stands up for his God-given identity, if he stands up for his family, right, he's told he's toxic to humanity. And then he's so toxic that he needs to be punished, canceled, and removed from society. And then according to our society now, that depending on your skin color, that's a determining factor of if you're an oppressor or not. So you may be a toxic oppressor if you have a certain skin color. Am I making this up, or are we living in this culture? Thank you. All right, so if the culture that we're living in convinces a man that he's a loser or that he's not good enough, right, and he could never be a good father, the culture tells you, well, you can just pretend you're a woman and it'll all work out okay. After they tell you what a toxic person you are as a male, then they tell you you can become a female and it'll all be good. Think of that lie, what it has done to our society, especially in the last couple of years. It's a lie from hell. And it's not only destroying men, it's destroying women and children too, right? It's a total mockery of women to see a man parading around with heels and makeup and all that stuff. It's a complete mockery of women to be beaten in sports by a man pretending he's a woman. These people have deep mental issues, and I'm not denying that. But it is so destructive to the nuclear family, like David said, because it's not just destroying men. It's destroying women, and it's destroying children. Therefore, it's destroying family. We're going to get pruned this morning. If I had to get pruned, you're going to get pruned, just because it's my turn to speak. So where does this all end up? What's the goal? Well, if you remove fathers in the purpose that God created them for, by default, you remove the family unit, right? Once you destroy family, Satan takes the kids. It's that simple. That's where all this is going. That's the end game here. It's the kids, the children, that the enemy is after, because that's the future generation. So if he destroys God's plan for fathers, he destroys the family, and when he destroys the family, what does he get? The kids. Remember that. If the enemy can dismantle fatherhood, he stops procreation. We talked about this a while ago. When we are teaching boys how to be girls instead of how to be men, the goal is no longer fatherhood and legacy. The goal is sexual perversion and decreased population. And what do I mean by that? When the government is paying our schools with our tax dollars, I might add, to convince our kids that they're the wrong gender and should explore other options. And when the government pays for our kids to have their gender changed with our tax dollars through hormone therapy or surgery, and when the government does this without parental consent, in fact, in California, I don't know if you've heard, there's a new bill. If a parent is not affirming a child's gender identity, it's to be classified as abuse. You could look this up yourself. It's Bill AB 957. It's like ingrained in my head. Parents can get arrested for not affirming what the school, through the funding of the government, has told your kid he now is or she now is. The parent can get arrested. When government is paying for these things to happen, you can rest assured that it is the enemy planning on stopping procreation. And when procreation stops, which is the goal right now, unfortunately, the kingdom of God stops growing. This all stems from fatherhood. God designed the kingdom of God to advance through family. We talked about that a lot here. We have to read the writing on the wall of what's going on. And what better day to talk about this on Father's Day? When pedophilia is no longer a crime, but a sexual preference, you have to know that Satan's after the kids. When rampant sex trafficking is not only winked at, but fueled by government, know that the enemy is wiping out our generation of kids. You need to watch out and pay attention to what's going on. Because the church, that's us, we will be held accountable for what happened in our day on our watch. This is not just a battle for our nation. This is a battle for humanity and for the kingdom of God, which advances through family. David mentioned about the steady decline in population all over the world. It's unprecedented. So yes, fatherhood is of utmost importance. It has always been, and it always will be. And if you're ever doubtful about how important fatherhood is, how important it is in the kingdom of God, I want you to think about one fact. Jesus referred to God as his father over 150 times in the Bible. And he also spoke of God being our father over 30 times. So that tells me, I mean, I would say fatherhood is pretty highly valued in the kingdom, wouldn't you? Okay, so with that, knowing I was going to be speaking on Father's Day, I started looking at fathers throughout the Bible. There's a lot of them, right? I thought about Adam having no instruction manual, nothing there precursor to him being a father, right? He had no manual, no nothing, no example to follow. And when his kids came along, and I tell you, that must have been a scary ride when I was thinking about that. Could you imagine? He was the first father. That's a little scary. A little scary for Eve, too, being the first mother. And then I thought about Noah being obedient when God made absolutely no sense, right? He was told to do something that had never been done before. Rain, much less a flood, was beyond anything not only him, but the culture had ever seen before, right? But he was obedient. He was obedient in that. And his kids listened to him. Imagine that. He got his kids to help build an ark for rain that they knew nothing about. So he must have done something right. I mean, just saying. He got all his... How did he do that? Anyway, I thought about Abraham, who really, patience wasn't his virtue, right? He didn't get the memo on that one, on being patient. However, even though he messed up big time to try and rush God's plan, yet because he was obedient to the Lord and was willing to sacrifice his son, God made him the father of Israel with offspring as numerous as the stars. I mean, that's a pretty incredible resume. Then I read about Jehonadab, and I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing this right. When we think of famous fathers in the Bible, I'm sure that's not the first name that rolls off our tongues, But if you read about this guy, he had an incredible impact on his family that lasted for generations to his children, his grandkids, his great-grandkids. And you know how we know that? In the Bible, it says he helped King Jehu, like, wipe out all the Baal worship, right? I'm not going to read it because it's a pretty lengthy part of the Bible. But years later, long after he's gone, Jeremiah met with some of his descendants, which is kind of cool. I don't know if you remember their name. They were called the Rechabites. There's a bunch of ites in the Bible, but they're called the Rechabites. They were still honoring him through their lives and their commitment to the Lord, because he had said to them, don't owe anybody anything, you live in tents. And they were still doing that like four generations later. I mean, what a legacy. What an impact he must have had on his family. And then I thought of Joseph, Jesus's dad. I mean, man, his whole theology must have been blown up when he got the word from God to marry Mary, right, who was carrying the Son of God. I mean, remember, the law said she was supposed to be put away. And just like Mary, I'm sure he put up with the sneering, the mockery, you know, the laughing at, and people who just didn't believe his story. His reputation, I'm sure, took quite a shot, you know. But he believed and obeyed God and had the incredible honor of raising the Son of God because of it. And I'm sure he thought it was worth the trouble. And the last earthly father I looked at was Jairus. And then I just had to stop because I felt like God really wanted me to park and pay attention, because he wanted to teach me something on it. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning. That's who we're going to talk about. So I'm going to read it as a story, like I always like to do, and hopefully shed some light on the dynamics, and that gives us more clarity. It's a well-known story, but there's some stuff in here that, I don't know about you, but I just never noticed before. It's in Luke chapter 8, beginning at verse 40. This is like a sandwich story. It starts with Jairus, then there's another story in the middle with the woman of the issue of blood, and then it ends with Jairus again. So I'm going to read that to you. So it was when Jesus returned that the multitude welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. But as he went, the multitudes thronged him. Now a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years, who had spent all her livelihood on physicians and could not be healed by any, came from behind him and touched the border of his garment. And immediately her flow of blood had stopped. And Jesus said, "Who touched me?" When all denied it, Peter and those who were with him said, "Master, the multitudes throng and press you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus said, "Somebody touched me, for I perceived power going out from me." Now when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling, and falling down before him, she declared to him in the presence of all the people the reason she had touched him and how she was healed immediately. He said to her, "Daughter, be of good cheer. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone came from the ruler of the synagogue's house saying to him, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher." But when Jesus heard it, he answered him saying, "Do not be afraid, only believe, and she will be made well." When he came into the house, he permitted no one to go in except Peter, James, and John, and the father and mother of the girl. Now all wept and mourned for her, but he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him, knowing that she was dead. But he put them all outside, took her by the hand, and called, saying, "Little girl, arise." Then her spirit returned, and she arose immediately. And he commanded that she be given something to eat. And her parents were astonished, but he charged them not to tell no one what had happened. Just want to take a drink. So we have a synagogue ruler, Jairus. And God kind of stopped me right in the beginning of the passage. And I started to look up what exactly a synagogue ruler did. What was their role and their function? And that's kind of where it got interesting. They were the ones who would schedule the worship in the synagogue. They would schedule the readings of the Torah. They were the keeper of the scrolls. Sometimes they even taught the Torah classes. They made sure the building was taken care of. They would pick out the sermons, and they also picked out who gave the sermons. They arranged the seating, who sat where in the prestigious seats. They would blow the shofar at the beginning of the Sabbath. It was like the spiritual leader of the synagogue. They were very highly respected. And synagogue rulers, which I did not know this, were typically very wealthy, influential members of the community. So it was an honored position. In fact, I read multiple places that today we would call that position president of the synagogue. So how did Jairus find out about Jesus? Well, before this incident happened, Jesus had taught in this very same synagogue. We read that in Luke chapter 4. And the people were amazed at his teaching, right? And they said that he spoke with authority. And at the very time when Jesus was speaking in the synagogue, a man, I don't know if you remember this, who was demon-possessed, he was going crazy, screaming and everything in the synagogue. Jesus cast the demon out of him right in the synagogue. It's very likely also that Jairus had picked Jesus to speak in the synagogue in Capernaum where he served. So this is kind of interesting. And then after Jesus cast that demon out in that synagogue, which was, you know, a pretty crowded synagogue, there was only one in Capernaum, the knowledge of Jesus, it said, it spread. So this power from Jesus is spreading like wildfire. The word about it is going crazy, right? And there's a really high chance that when this happened, Jairus was there watching that this had happened. He may not know that Jesus is the Messiah, but he certainly knows that this man, Jesus, has authority. And if we dig in a little deeper, do you remember the story of the Roman centurion whose servant was sick and dying, right? And Jesus came to heal him. David touched on this last week. That's found in the chapter before this story that we just read about Jairus. That's in Luke chapter 7. I want to read to you 5 verses from it in Luke chapter 7. Now, when he concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. And a certain centurion servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. So when he heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying, that one for whom he should do this was deserving. For he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. This Roman centurion was the ruler over Capernaum that had actually had this synagogue built for the Jews, where Jairus was the ruler. And from what I read, it was one of the most beautiful synagogues in the entire area that existed at that time. Now, you guys know the story. This centurion had so much faith in Jesus that he sends his servants to ask Jesus to heal him at a distance. He said, you don't even need to come to my house. I am so unworthy. I can't even imagine what his history was. He said, please just heal him because I know you have the power. And Jesus heals him from that very moment. So Jairus, being the ruler of that synagogue when this happened, obviously knows about it, okay? In fact, the synagogues of the day back in that time, they were community centers, right? Jairus likely reported into that Roman centurion who was over that whole area on a governmental level. So he's well aware of this, what had happened, and that there's a man named Jesus who is doing miracles and has power to heal. He knows that Jesus was willing to heal a slave person, a slave, even though it was Roman, it was at a Roman's request, I should say. It might have been a Jew, but it was at a Roman request. And he heals him without being anywhere near the man. So Jairus knows this. And now Jairus' daughter's on her deathbed and he's desperate, right? Suddenly, this prestigious position didn't mean anything to Jairus anymore. Suddenly, scheduling the worship readings and keeping the scrolls and the Torah readings, it wasn't so important. And that beautiful building meant nothing to him. Suddenly, following the narrative of the priests and the Pharisees, wasn't his top priority. See, the priests and the Pharisees were the leaders in the synagogue as far as teaching. The Sanhedrin, which was above them, were the ones who taught at the temple. There was a lot of animosity between them because they didn't see things eye to eye on a lot of things. There was so much infighting right within, quote unquote, the church of the day. But Jairus, he suddenly realized that being a dad was the most important thing in the world to him. And everything that was in his head about his position, what he was talking about, like what he learned about the church and the rulers and how to run things, it went out the window. And everything in his heart became his reality. Nothing else mattered to him at that point. His fatherly instinct and love took over, and he ran to help for someone who was despised among the religious leaders. The priests and the Pharisees hated Jesus. And I'm sure by now, Jairus was warned not to associate with this man Jesus. But by that point, I don't think he cared what the religious leaders thought of him. He just wanted his daughter to live. But Jesus' presence already had a history in that synagogue. Jesus already made his mark there, and Jairus knew that. And when a parent is desperate, they'll take the crumbs that falls from the parent, from the master's table, right? Jairus had to be thinking at that point, if he healed a Roman centurion's slave, there's a chance he'll heal my daughter too. And Jairus is actually waiting for Jesus to return to Capernaum so he can meet up with him. How do we know that? Because if you go back and read it again, and in chapter 7, verse 40 and 41, it says, "So it was when Jesus returned that the multitudes welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, who was ruler of the synagogue, and he fell down and begged Jesus to come to his house." Jesus had just returned to Capernaum from the country area, the Gadarenes. Remember, he healed, sent all the demons into the pigs? That's what happened right before this. And then Jesus crosses over. He got off the boat across the Sea of Galilee, and the crowd's there waiting for him. Jairus is in that crowd. That's a man who loves his daughter. He falls down. He's waiting for Jesus. He falls down at his feet, and he begs Jesus, "Please come heal my daughter." And I'm willing to bet the bank there's quite a few people in that crowd that recognize him. And I'm sure that many, because those people were the local people of the community. They went to synagogue. So now he's kind of caught out in this. Apparently he didn't care if word got back at that point to the priests and the Pharisees that he was in the crowd looking for Jesus. Don't think for one minute that the priests and the Pharisees would have taken this lightly either. He knew at this point he just blew up his religious reputation out the window. In John 12:42, it's not on the screen, but it says in one of the verses, even the rulers that did believe didn't confess it because the Pharisees would remove them from the synagogue. Remember when Jesus healed the blind man on the Sabbath and the Pharisees were furious about it? They went to his parents to ask what happened. Not to confirm the miracle. They saw that his eyes were open to see if they believed that Jesus was the Messiah. That's why they did that. And I'm going to read that to you. John chapter 9, verses 20 to 23. You have to realize the impact that this was making when Jairus went to Jesus. And this is what it says, the parents of the man who was born blind. "We know our son," the parents answered, "and we know he was born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid Can you imagine being afraid of people in the church, of the Jewish leaders who already had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue? And that's why his parents said, he is of age, ask him. The narrative that was being pushed by the leaders of that day was, Jesus is of the devil, and he's not the Messiah. Got it? If you spread misinformation like Jesus is the Messiah, you were kicked out of the meeting place, the community center. That's what the synagogue was, the gathering place. That's what it actually means. In Acts chapter 18, Paul is speaking in the synagogue in Corinth, and it mentions that Christus, the ruler of that synagogue, gets saved and his whole family gets saved, and the Jewish leaders in Corinth are furious. They're furious with Paul because so many people and families are actually getting saved. Gentiles, Greeks, everybody's getting saved, right? They're being converted. And then a few verses after that, we read that Sosthenes, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, these names just drive me nuts, is now a ruler of the synagogue, and he's beaten mercilessly by unsaved Greeks. Now, they are believed in Jewish history to be Jewish Greeks, and he's beaten mercilessly, this ruler of the synagogue, right in front of the Roman governor, who was like, I don't care, what's that to me? The Pharisees and the religious leaders were livid that the rulers of the synagogue were getting saved. This is how much the religious leaders of the day were against rulers coming to believe in Jesus. This is what Jairus was up against. But Jairus was a father before he was a religious leader. Jairus didn't care about what the crowd was thinking or saying. He didn't care that he was going to be severely reprimanded and more than likely ostracized from the synagogue. And probably after reading this in Acts 18, there's a good chance he might have gotten beat up. You know, they might have gotten their boys to take care of him behind the synagogue. The humility, the determination, and the desperation of this man is the very thing that proves to us, well, certainly proved it to me, that he was one of the bravest fathers in the Bible. He didn't fear the crowd, he didn't fear the backlash, and he didn't fear the Pharisees. He knew what was coming. The only thing he feared for was his daughter's life. Let me tell you something. We are called to a lifestyle of courage. We are living in days right now that require us to make a decision on who we're going to listen to, where our allegiance is. Are we going to listen to the crowd, which may be the local government or the federal government or the state government, or are we going to listen to what God says? And I feel like I say this a lot, but it's a true statement. We have to start asking ourselves some tough questions. Both the woman who had the issue of blood and Jairus come to Jesus and get noticed because they literally have to push through a crowd and fall down on their knees in front of him. Not every single one of those people in that crowd believed in Jesus, but they were willing to go the extra mile, to do what was hard to do, to get to Jesus. And I want you to think about that for a minute. There are going to be times when we have to push through everything around us, the good, the bad, and the ugly, to get to Jesus, to see what he tells us to do, what to say, where to go, how to respond. There are times that call for intense courage, and I feel like that's where we are right now. So Jesus begins walking to Jairus' house, and this woman with the issue of blood pushes through the crowd and touches his garment, and Jesus famously says, "Who touched me?" Right? Long story short, she makes her unexpected journey back to Jesus. She had zero intentions of walking back to Jesus, making herself known to the crowd. So she comes forward. You guys know the story. Jesus heals her. And while this is going on, someone from Jairus' house comes and says, your daughter's dead. So what we see here is that Jairus had a plan. This woman had a plan. And Jesus disrupted both of them. Jairus is believing that Jesus could heal his daughter if he can get him to come to his house. But his faith just took a huge blow, right? Because his daughter's dead now. He's just been told, it's too late. Your daughter's dead. Don't bother the master anymore. Mind you, the person who came was from Jairus' house. We don't know who it was, but more than likely it was somebody that he knew, like a friend that came to tell him that. Jairus's plan just got blown up. This woman with the issue of blood, her plan is to remain unknown, unseen. She doesn't want anybody to know what's going on. Jesus disrupted both their plans because our faith doesn't reside in a thing like laying on of hands or the touching of a garment. Our faith has to lie in the relationship of the person of Jesus Christ. And that's what I believe Jesus is trying to get across. Jesus challenged Jairus to stop fearing and keep believing in him, even when it seemed impossible. Jesus challenged this woman's plan, not by just healing her physically, but actually seeing her and connecting with her. He was able to give her wholeness, not just healing, when he addressed her need for him. He made her part of the family when he called her daughter, which would have never happened had she put her faith in his garment. Our faith has to reside in the person of Jesus Christ, not our plans. Jairus' plan failed. This woman's plan failed because she got called out anyway. Yes, she got healed, but she wasn't made whole and was not in relationship yet with Jesus until he called her back. God always has a plan. David talked about this last week, but it may not be fulfilled the way we think it should be fulfilled. God's always stretching us, right? That's how we grow. It's like the pruning Sue spoke about. About 2 weeks ago, our basil was looking really puny. So you know what I did? I went outside, and I know how to do this stuff because of my mom. My mom just, tiny little garden, but man, every day we had to go out there with her and weed and water. So I know the stuff like the back of my hands. I just don't like to do it. It's too much work. So I got my scissors and went out there, and I like cultivated around it, and I cut all the tops, which I hate to do because I feel like it's so hard to cut something and believe it's good for it, but I know it is. And, you know, I'm cutting all around the basil, and you know what? A week later, the basil started coming back again, and now I got to do it again for the back row. There's something in the pruning that's, even though it's ouch, it's good for us, right? We start growing again after a cutting. So here's Jairus, devastated. He got the news his daughter is dead, and Jesus immediately addresses it. He says, don't trust in what man says, trust in what I say, and I say she will live. That's basically what he said to him. We have to learn to trust Jesus to define reality and truth, not the crowd. And you know what stands out here in both cases? Jesus doesn't even flinch at what the crowd is saying. He doesn't even flinch at what people say. He doesn't entertain it. He doesn't entertain what's being said or done in the earth realm. Hello? He's not put off by the crowds. He's not deterred by it at all. He's not deterred by people, not even his disciples. When the woman who touched the hem of his garment and Jesus said, who touched me? Peter said, you know, there's dozens of people. Like, are you kidding me? Peter was speaking of a physical reality. But that physical reality is still subject to Jesus' definition of reality. And what he says is truth. What Peter said was true. There was a lot of people touching him. But Jesus spoke his truth into the situation. He said, yes, but there was a touch because I felt the power going out of me. When this man came from Jairus' house to break the news to him that his daughter was dead, Look at the way he words it. She's dead. No need to bother the master. You know what that word literally means? To annoy, to harass, and to bother. No need to waste the master's time. It's time to stop this nonsense and come home. That's what that man was saying. Let me let you in on a little secret. That man who came from Jairus' house wasn't worried about wasting Jesus' time. He was trying to convince Jairus to give up because your master was too late. You've lost the battle, Jairus. He was trying to influence him to give up. So now we have the physical reality on one side of the battle. What the man said was true, right? His daughter was dead. And then we have Jesus's reality, the truth, believe and she will live. That's on the other side of the battle, right? But we get a clear picture here that Jesus isn't moved at all by the influencers. Hear me, what I'm saying. Even the influencers don't change God's plan. The groomers don't change God's plan for our sons and our daughters, for our grandchildren. Are you hearing me? When it's true in the when what's true, I should say, in the earth realm doesn't line up with God's truth, we have to choose what we are going to believe. We have to speak the truth into that lie to change the outcome. We can speak God's truth into that lie and change the outcome. You guys getting this? Jesus immediately turns to Jairus and says, "Don't be afraid, believe in me, and she will be made well." Don't be afraid. Fear not, or do not fear, depending on what translation you're looking in, is the most quoted command in Scripture. You guys probably know that. Guess how many times it's mentioned? 365. One for every day of the year. Isn't that incredible? At that very moment, Jairus had to choose who he would believe. Fortunately, he chose Jesus' reality and truth over fear. Had he believed those who were sent to kill God's plan for the future for his family, Jairus and his wife would not have only missed the miracle of watching their daughter being resurrected, it would have changed the entire remainder of their lives as a family. Say this with me. What I choose to believe in determines my future. Remember, this is their only daughter. Thank God Jairus was willing to fight for her. We are living in a day right now where we don't have a choice but to fight for our family if we want God's outcome. There are those who are sent to us to cause us not to believe that God will save our kids. That's exactly what's going on right now. Please hear me on this. The plan of the enemy is and has always been to steal, kill, and destroy. And there is an all-out onslaught on our kids and our grandkids. And if you don't believe me, just do a Google search on family-friendly drag shows in your state or city and watch what comes up. Do you know they're even rated on Yelp now? Yeah, that's where we're at. The pornographic books and curriculums and libraries are even becoming protected now because states are outlawing banning books. But yet, ironically enough, I can't remember which state it was, just banned the Bible because they said it was too vulgar to leave in the library. There are those who are being sent by the enemy to destroy our kids and our future generations. They know these drugs they're giving them are going to make them sterile and not able to produce offspring. And there are those who are sent to come after us, the parents and grandparents, telling us it's too late. It's useless to believe for change. Oh, yes, they've been sent. Some are even sent by our government. Sent to tell us we can't raise our kids or grandkids in the ways of the Lord. sense to tell us that our kids belong to them once they go to school. Sent to tell us that we will be thrown in jail and categorized as terrorists if we act up and oppose these filthy pornographic books that they're feeding our kids in school. Sent to tell us if you don't affirm your child's new identity once we confuse them, that you'll be arrested. This is all real stuff. I'm not making any of this up. Just this week, the Pride Festival in DC that was going on, our so-called president of the United States said, and I quote, "These are our kids. Even the neighbors' kids, they're our kids." I said, oh, heck no, not on my watch, over my dead body. They're not your kids. They're the parents' kids. They belong to the parents, not government and not the state. Proverbs 1:8 says, "Hear the instruction of your father, not the government." Ephesians 6 says, I'm not sure if it's verse 1. Don't quote me on that. I know it's in Ephesians 6. "Children, obey your parents, not the government. Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." So just think of poor J. Iris. They were coming from his house. Be careful who you let into your house. And I don't necessarily mean your literal house. All right, I have to move on. I could stay on that for another hour, but I'm not. So Jesus gets to Jairus' house, and these mourners are there. And Jesus asks them, "Why are you mourning? She's not dead, she's sleeping." And that demonic, mocking spirit that they're carrying begins laughing and sneering at Jesus and trying to cause even more unbelief in Jairus and the disciples. So Jesus kicks them right out of the house. Jairus didn't think to put them out. The disciples didn't think to put them out. But Jesus said, get out of the house. Jesus cast out demons when people didn't even realize he was doing it. Jesus never negotiated with demons, and neither should we. Why didn't Jesus say to them, just stay here and watch, and you'll see the glory of God so they could, you know, so you could be saved? Because he was as wise as a serpent, and he knew the enemy. He knew they had no desire to know God. See, this is where discernment comes in. They were just more people from the crowd who were being used, being sent by Satan to try and convince Jairus and the disciples, really, not to believe what Jesus said. I think they're what we call today groomers and influencers, being paid to convince everyone in the town that this little girl would never live again. She'd never be the same. Trying to convince that Jesus was a fake. Kind of sounds like our current education system, what our tax dollars pay for, right? Remember what David said last week? God takes us out of situations, out of people circles, where our belief will be compromised. He quoted Mark 8:22. You don't have to go there. It's not on the screen. Jesus took the man who was blind by the hand and brought him out of the village.
And he told him not to go back.
Yeah, not to go back. Yep, that's right. Mark chapter 6, verse 5. This one is up there. And because of their unbelief, he couldn't do any miracles among them except to place his hands on a few sick people and heal them. Don't you think that Satan knows that our unbelief is the very thing that stands in the way of Jesus doing a miracle in our lives? Of course he knows that. Why do you think he works so hard at convincing us that Jesus doesn't have the power to do the miracle that we're asking him for? He knows that our unbelief will stop the miracle from happening. And sometimes people are sent into our lives to do just that. Sometimes the best thing you can do, hear me on this, is to separate yourself from those who may cause you not to believe. If Jesus did it, so should we. Again, Jesus has to define our reality and truth, not the crowd. He should be defining that for us, not the crowd. There's a lot of competition for headspace right now, and a lot of people have fear living in their heads rent-free. We have to discern the truth and then believe in it. Jairus' story would have had a very different ending had he listened to the crowd instead of Jesus, right? Jairus' story would have had a very different ending if he believed those who were sent instead of Jesus. We have to learn to see things like Jesus sees them and not like the crowd. It's this clarity of vision that we keep hearing about, right? Even when we have to step out in faith to see that vision, most times, we don't see the whole vision, right? But we have to take baby steps. Listen, Jairus didn't even have the faith of the Roman centurion, because the Roman centurion, remember, he sent word to Jesus and said, "You don't even have to come in my house to heal my servant." And Jairus was like, "No, I need Jesus here." You know what? And Jesus was okay with that. He meets us where we are. And I'm convinced that Jesus was not only doing this for Jairus' sake, he was doing this for his disciples' sake as well. They still had a lot of unbelief. And this is not a shot to his disciples. But when Jesus told them, if you remember this, that Lazarus was dead, they were like, "What? You let him die?" And you know what he said to his disciples? "I am glad for your sakes that I was not there so you might believe." I mean, I'm guessing even after seeing all those miracles that Jesus did, they still had some unbelief that had to be dealt with. Just saying. And you're not going to convince me that Peter, James, and John, when they were on their way to Jairus' house, had the complete faith for the resurrection of his daughter. This was not only stretching Jairus' faith, this was stretching the disciples' faith as well. But at least they wanted to believe, unlike the ones that Jesus kicked out. I can't even imagine what was going through Jairus' head at this point. And as the saying goes, faith begins at the end of your comfort zone. And I think Jairus must have been long past his comfort zone at this point. 1 minute, he's this highly respected leader in the community, and the next minute, he's a heartbroken father begging for Jesus to heal his daughter. And I don't know about you, but I prefer the latter. I'd prefer a loving father who was willing to give up his reputation, his livelihood, his status, everything he worked his whole life for, than a high-ranking respected leader of the community who just happens to be my father. I'd rather that kind of father who was willing to give up everything. Like we heard last week, blessed are those who believe without seeing. And I'm sure Jairus was radically blessed because he believed. That's the kind of fathers and mothers that we need today. Those who are brave enough to risk it all to find the truth that only Jesus brings us. So let's rise up. I'm going to make a few declarations. We're going to start believing, and I mean start believing what Jesus says and not the crowd. What Jesus says and not those who are sent to cause unbelief in us. So let's make these couple declarations. Jesus defines my reality and truth. I have discernment to distinguish between the voice of the Lord and the voice of the crowd. I will not be afraid, but believe in what God says. I will fight to save my children and my family. Amen.